Interview with Labroy, WJF. No date.
The question of this vindictiveness on the part of the British in 1915, there is a chair, I think you made the point that they were somewhat wanted to...
The charge against... Yes?
They wanted to teach them a lesson more or less.
Yes. That charge was widely made. And I think that pretty strong individuals you can't witness in the petition to the department. Certainly the way Mr. was trying to set about things there, I suppose they didn't know very much about law and partly ignorance.
Now I was thinking of bringing this official vindictiveness as distinct from actions in the field on the part of
The harshness towards painters was common talk, and I believe it got in the papers as soon as the bans were removed and so on.
About this chair being brought out.
I don't remember the chair instrument exactly. What was it about the chair?
No, Gunasinghe says that the chair on which he was seated when he was shot, like, was brought and kept where they were exactly.
Oh, that sort of thing. I mean, they'll be for remembering I was on 5 years old. I came to Western College in 1921. But they're still talking about the superintendent of the, the Inspector General of Prisons of that time. I'm not sure the name was Walker. They were always contrasting him with his successor, who was also an Englishman. That doesn't represent the government itself.
But personally, I'm inclined to believe Gunasinghe. And anyway, I have found confirmation in a roundabout way. It was mostly Edmund Gunaratne. Told me that Sri Sen had told him that he cut up. Of course, whether it was deliberate or accidental is another
question. I didn't
put it past them.
To say they did it.
At the same time, I'm inclined to sort of be critical of this levy, you know, the money which they extracted, as a form of blackmail. Well, they told some people, if you don't pay up, you'll be charged.
You will be prosecuted for refusing to pay. It was compulsory, it was made compulsory.
No, I think they will be prosecuted for other...
I don't think that I have not heard. But certainly that people were told that they must pay. I had some even asked, who's this? Devaturyajana? James P. Sir, other people was told that he must pay.
Son.
J.J. Peter's son.
Elder.
Elder.
Elder son.
No, little Peter died. The elder son died. But Devaturyajana was far more concerned with trying to write that, with helping the people in writing that biography too. And he certainly bear that out. Bandaranaike's remembered yesterday, I think they are also, he says that. They use strange arguments and it certainly was.
In the official proclamation, the official proclamation which instituted this levy, I felt it has a ring of virtual literature. An expression, I would call it blackmail. Wasn't Charles Dyce, for instance, told that he had to, that Wesley Marston...
Once he flapped, CP, yes, but...
CP Dyce.
Yes.
That he had to pay a certain sum or else.
I don't remember the old man telling us that.
That is a vague recollection I have, maybe from Ramananda.
He was, maybe Ramananda came into it. But he was a tough guy. He was probably a minister. I certainly know that Mr. Haidu got into was killed up for his self-defense of Mr. P.P. I still remember the printer is I relating how he interviewed for his papers and so on, but all the issues were done. So he saw that young man, Akhil, purposely putting his new article in his name, and the morale and optimism came. The article's father was a personal friend of CPJS.
Mm-hmm.
such doses are observed in just one more sort of interesting area. The question of this our nationalists of that era in the 1900s and 1910 and their thinking, you know, people like James P. C.W. Pereira and others. Am I here?
No.
What would... Shall I come later? I'm going...
I'll go to 5, yeah. And I'll be back by 6:30.
I was very interested in the school curriculum because sometimes it probed the intellectual inspirations they were likely to have got.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of, say, an average middle-class individual who did not go to England for postgraduate work, but completed his studies at one of the good public schools in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
So even in your time in the 20s, in the arts line, what would the subjects have been?
Well, I think art, teaching was very much dominated and guided by the Cambridge local examination that they were the curriculum was definitely wider than it is today. A student was allowed to read as many as, to study as many as 10 subjects, though that wouldn't be usual in a school. Still, in a school you would have 8 quite distinct subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Worked, I think, at a rather wider level than today.
Now I notice now that particularly in the 1910s and, you know, earlier, say in case of Bandaranaike and others, classics seems to have been one of the very popular spheres.
Yes.
Would that contribute to concepts of freedom and political growth and the classics that was taught in Ceylon?
Not much, I fear, well, except that Greek, Greek certainly would contribute more than Latin.
Mm-hmm.
I think already by my time, by 1920s, you got the idea of freedom and nationalism and so on from your studies. It came more by way of history than by way of your practical studies.
History being the history of Britain and Europe?
Yes, generally, yes. More often British history was the staple diet, British history. Very little scholarship of it, and that was lower down the school,
I was wondering to what extent they would have picked up concepts which go under the term British liberalism. Say through studying history or even literature, I wonder whether they would have...
Well, not the finer shades of it. That, mm-hmm. I suppose, I personally didn't get to. I studied political theory at University College.
Mm-hmm.
But the broad idea certainly did come through.
Mm-hmm. The broad idea.
Would the better student at the Cambridge matric level have read people like Macaulay.
Oh yes. Not to the extent of your chapter, for instance. Since you mentioned Macaulay, Macaulay's famous third chapter, which is in the beginning of 1680, was a frequent textbook. It was rather smaller than the average textbook that I said. You would get the idea of freedom coming into English literature too. You might get a bit of Carlyle or Ruskin.
So Macaulay then would have been fairly familiar to certain
people. Yes. And I think too there was far more done in literary associations and debating societies and so on. And that students took a bigger part in those things than they do students today.
Apart from Macaulay, what about others? Would they have come up to the level of Hume and Locke and...
No, definitely not. That was too much for you. After all, a good candidate would have done with his Cambridge senior when he was 17 plus, before he was 18. He was 18, he was over age. And he wouldn't have Locke.
What about people like Bagot and Maine? Did that come into the syllabus?
No. That again, we would get in the first year at University College, British Constitution. No.
And University College began in?
1931.
I thought so. So the others really before that era wouldn't have had that come up to that level.
Before that era, no. If they continued after the intermediate, some of the best teachers in those days had only got the intermediate, and believe me, they were much better informed than many of our graduates. But that's because they went beyond what was needed for the inter. Don't make that mistake.
Were there any of those teachers who you would class as leading or sort of second level figures in the nationalist movement?
That type of teacher? Not many. No, they I'm afraid the schoolmaster seldom took a part in politics. It was very exceptional to have a man like Mr. C.P. D.S. at Wesley College, or there were one or two in Jaffna. Did take part in politics.
Was D.S. from Farnham, or any relation?
No. He is Kalamba. I just don't know his connections. And yes.
What about those who went to Britain? I'm just thinking that many of them were really rich land-owning families, and say the Bisoyas and Obeisekras and others. I don't know whether they would have had all that much in the way of brains, but...
Well, I don't know that. They did do fairly well. Some of them very well. Some of the soils in particular were really wealthy, not just wealthy. Mm-hmm. You did get the type of really wealthy, but even he came back with a stronger civic sense and certainly with his nationalism aroused.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm thinking that people like, certainly Bulton's got a lot of inspiration from
Cambridge. Yes.
And probably there are now people like James Pierce would have read much more widely. And
oh yes, sure.
But I was wondering whether any of them did come up to the level of being able to read and gain inspiration from people like Mill and Locke. John Stuart Mill.
I think so. I think that we are talking really of a generation one earlier than mine.
Yes.
When, if possible, reading in literature, and particularly the reading on this fringe of politics and civics and so on, was carried much further, if possible, than even in my time. Because by my time, there was more of a balance with science, and though science wasn't carried as far as it is today, well, every boy certainly studied one science subject up to the senior level, and many of them studied two or three.
What about doctors? I mean, in a generation before you, speaking generally, could it be said that, say, with the exception of people like Lucian de Silva, their reading would have been less wide?
I'm afraid so. That is so. The doctor then had the repute of being, well, a good sort of fellow, a hail fellow, well met, and plenty of common sense and so on, but not intellectual. He stuck to his books far more than the art student, and he was nowhere near. If you weren't good enough for the civil service, then you might try to become a doctor. Unless, as you said, you were really interested in medicine. There were always, apart from the distinguished people you mentioned, there were people genuinely interested.
If I may branch off, I was very interested in, when you were discussing that article of mine, you said something about Dharmapala and what he stood for.
Yes.
I was wondering whether, I can't quite recall it, so I was wondering whether you could elaborate on...
I think what he stood for was simply that he was practically the first person in Ceylon who said very clearly and very loud that for nearly everything that the West could teach us, we had something as good in our own traditions, if not something better. He deplored, shall we say, the universal use of Sinhalese, of English names for Sinhalese boys and girls. Spoke rather scathingly about it and showed his contempt. And
so in this sense he tended to concentrate on symbols, but with a
very, very good perception of the mentality which those symbols created. That in quite neutral things, like names for one thing and dress for another, the use of the Western, even when it was justified, particularly dress, I would say still that the Western dress is more convenient, it was creating a mentality which led people look down on things unduly and fail to notice that there were certain advantages in these things.
Fail to notice?
That there were certain advantages in the local dress, even though in some ways the Western dress is more convenient, that local was...
But was it so much perception rather than a reaction against the social attitudes of the top Ceylonese of the time?
There was that also, certainly. There was that also, but I think he was able to see that these people weren't deliberately being snobbish, but they genuinely thought, no, this is the done thing and that is something inferior, and he felt, well, this has become unconscious almost, the lying, the soul, and he certainly exposed that lie. That was his thing.
Would it be correct to say that in the way he presented this critique, the way he was extremist, and he gave the impression of rejecting all things Western.
Yes, he certainly did. He certainly did, and so many people thought he was completely shallow. looking back today, we see that he wasn't all that shallow, that there was a real perception. Though it is true that, like so many people who were there, he was strongly about a thing, he did tend to overuse. But he couldn't afford, you see, he couldn't afford to kind of make concessions.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to apply a theory propounded by Lerner and others in the introduction to Singers. These are two sociologists, I think, and they said that some of these traditionalists, tended to, shall I put it this way, would it be correct to say that while he was harping on these traditions and attacking these things Western, many of his concepts and his inspirations was drawn from the West? Or some of them, sorry.
A good deal of them, I should say, in the sense that he learned from the West that the idea that, well, our own is as good as anybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
And that he is sort of learned to stand up for himself, to speak up for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he got his confidence was from the West. And also, yes, in matters like punctuality and strict, courtesy,
mm-hmm.
honest, plain speaking, instead of trying to see what the other person wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Those were points which he had learned from the West, consciously or unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, here are the things where we are falling short. Not in matters like speech or dress or
mm-hmm.
music and so forth. Well, in those matters, we got things quite as good as they.
Mm-hmm. This is Lerner's and then model is that some of these figures incorporate certain Western concepts and attitudes, a sort of partial incorporation,
yes.
which they use then to reject reject the others.
Yes, that did happen in this case.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, his energy
mm-hmm.
was definitely what he associated more with an Englishman than one of our people.
But
his energy was more what he associated with the Westerner in the province than with our own people.
And even in terms of symbols, couldn't it be said that while he was attacking, say, the Western dress, Western names and so on and so forth, he was willing to use a Western type caravan and
was it a Western type caravan? That was Fiji. I thought that was a stunt. I don't know whether he merely wanted to attract attention or what that was. And the thing like that well, gave people openings to ridicule him, whereas the motive for ridiculing, of course, was that the things he said hurt.
But I was thinking of the instruments he used, after all the press, I mean, that was...
Yes, well, those things, I suppose he regarded as not being peculiarly Western.
Mm-hmm.
He regarded them as being more modern, and after all, his whole point was culture is a growing thing, it need not necessarily remain medieval, and you are the people who are there, and the Westerners are the people who are there, religion, culture, and so on, as something which has stagnated. True, it has stagnated, but my job is to show that it's capable of growth and adaptation without being forced to itself. I think that's really what where his greatest lay,
mm-hmm.
in showing that the unchanging East is a myth.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't this
form of traditionalism, pretty common, at least common among the nationalist-minded people of the time. Now take all this Mundaliya Dissanayake, A.K. Ananda Kumar Swami and others, the work of the Ceylon National Review. They also, in a different ways maybe, but they may stress this line.
They were more consciously Western, surely. Now,
they were
on one hand, knew a great deal about art, dance forms, and so on. But he felt wrong that he was writing for a Western audience, that he was trying to give the information of the East and put it into Western forms. And he would sometimes point out, well, that our canons of excellence, the Eastern canon, was different from the Western. But even so, he would prove that it was equal by using Western criteria.
Now you see, I've just been reading some of these articles in the National Review, you know, and there is a lot of this retrospective romanticism and traditionalism.
There was that also. There was that also, I would say.
Both in Kumaraswamy and Snack and some others, you see. And I agree that they don't go as far as Dharmapala, and probably they, in dress and other ways, they were more Westernized. And that they were not as militant in the words they use. But they do stress this on national lines, and the fact that British rule has not been in consonance with Eastern traditions. Oh, this is very clear in Dissanayake's articles.
I see.
It's 1906, 1908.
Yes, I'm afraid
I'm
not very familiar with his
writing. It's not very deep, it's very shallow, but it does reflect an attitude. And
but now, the other man, Ananda Kumar Swami, would he complain that these things are not in keeping with Eastern traditions, or did he complain about them being not in keeping with the best Western traditions? Wasn't Ananda Kumar Swami's complaints against colonial rule and what colonial rule had done for us, mainly on those lines, we are being given the inferior products of the West. I want the superior products of the West, which is the best in the world today. And I would apply that, and he did certainly aim at a real fusion.
Yes.
But he seldom took his absolute status from the East. I don't know that I'm generalizing too far. I haven't analyzed him carefully. But that's the impression I got.
Yes. Now, of course, the subject that I was reading about was really the village community and rural administration, and that subject which lends itself to this traditionalism.
Oh, yes. And Westerners had misled us on that point, hadn't they? They saw certain superficial similarities to the primitive and Tilkonic village and so on, between them and the Aryan village community. Packed it up, and it was left to the next generation to study the facts a little more carefully, to say, well, this resemblance is really a false one. There's no proof that this was genuinely democratic at all.
But from what I read, it also would appear that at that time all these elements were pressing for education on national lines. So that would seem to indicate a certain awareness among these people.
Yes.
On Dharmapala's lines, though perhaps not quite in the same way.
Yes, that would be true, but how far did they take it? How far?
what were they willing to do? I remember Mr. Donald Obeshekar saying that how foolish in one sense, or better still, is the right word I used to use, how humbled he felt when he went on a deputation to meet a quite able director of education, I forget whom he mentioned. The object of his deputation being to say that Ceylon history should be taught in Ceylon schools. And the director turned around and told him, well, if you mention one book from which I can teach Ceylon history in Ceylon schools, I'll go ahead with it. And he thanked him for the very courteous rebuke implied in that. And he sat down and wrote his book on the history of Ceylon. He told him that's entirely the reason which prompted him to sit down and do that. But there, again with Donald Obey, first by Donald Obey, basically, you would have that. His standards were really Western.
Mm-hmm.
His interests were home.
Yes, and social...
Socially, entirely Western.
Mm-hmm. That's the difference, that's where he
stood for everything which Dharmapala rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Dharmapala could say, well, there is a certain justification for what you are doing, but you have failed to discriminate, and so you are anathema to me.
Another sphere, completely different. I don't know whether you know anything about this. This is something I'm really seeking information on, purely on one lead given by the HZ Fernand during some conversation. Senators had wanted him to contest CE Korea in Chilao because Korea was forming Singhalese Tamil pact, you see. This suggests that as early as the 20s, that the Chennaika group were not willing to give too many concessions to the Tamils. It was somewhere on the mid 20s.
Really? No, I don't think I can help at all there. I simply wasn't aware of that. And I don't think. Taken on the whole that C.H. Zephrendo was being entirely fair in that matter,
mm-hmm.
in representing Chennai as being so rabid a nationalist.
He was not presenting it as a criticism, he was boasting about it.
How do you mean?
He was talking about himself.
12 years.
About how he defeated C.A. Korea. I mean, he was not, he didn't, so this came in incidentally, and it was not in critical way.
Yes, but I understood you to suggest that what needed defeat in Korea was that he was negotiating for pacts with the Tamils.
Yes. Definitely there was something, but it just doesn't tie up with C.H. Zephrendo because this pact business was an official thing inaugurated by the CNC in 1926, if you look up the handbook.
Now I begin to see what there may be to it.
Yeah.
That people like Senanayake or even B.B. Jalabhesha felt that there was far too much of bargaining and hickling and haggling between Sinhalese and Tamils. The Tamils were far too cautious and inclined to write down their claims and spell out their claims without going on the free and easy assumption that first and foremost we are all Ceylonese, and while there are some differences of interest, that is a very subordinate matter. So they are putting the differences and the need to solve these differences by formula far too prominent in their whole political thinking and outlook.
Mm-hmm.
That I can understand.
You see, it's really the fact that they had a good conscience about this matter.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't being too familiar minded. They came from a background where you had this idea of Sila Nis. And communal differences and antagonisms and jealousies in particular occupied only after all a minor place in their thinking.
As a small query about D.S.A. Nayaka, you know, he's saying that he did a lot for agriculture in the 30s. But I was talking with Jerry and we are beginning to wonder whether he himself in the 1910s and 20s was a bit of a land speculator and land grabber.
Grabber, I don't know.
Well,
but
you know,
in the 1920s, he was one of the first to, among unofficial members, to make a big, give a big place in his thinking and speaking to such things as colonizing projects in the dry zone, and urge that the evil of malaria wasn't as complete an obstacle as most people took it to be in those days.
No, the point is that he collaborated with E.A.P. Vijayaratna and A.A. Vikramasinghe in that pamphlet, 1924.
Mm-hmm.
And that pamphlet represents the viewpoint, the traditional criticism of this wasteland policy. But it's also virtually sort of lock, stock and barrel, an argument presented by the Kegala Mahajana Sabha in the 1917 sort of period.
Mm-hmm.
So the A.A. Vikramasinghe was behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And that in 1917 had been put forward by a speculator as a defense for his claim to some land.
Always have an individual who catches hold of a good thing.
Yes, but
it suits him.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't follow that all the people who were working for this good thing had quite so interested a motive.
No, but there are so other signs, like the fact that, well, Jerry knows more about this, but he was a visiting agent for many estates somewhere around 1950, 1920.
Yes.
A little while later, he owned them. And, few estates, and it's just not known now.
Mm-hmm.
But Lal, I know, is not England thing of Saint Nike is not involved in, though some of the others are, certainly Victor Puria and Charles Patwantudas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I'm afraid I don't know enough to say anything either way. But I can't see how, if he had been that, he could have lived down the name which he wears, the bad name.
Uh-huh.
I think that is something which he's got to bear in mind. Because after all, bad names stick.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can't understand how Victor Correa got a bad name. It's partly, I know, I feel, because of this. And his brother didn't, because both of them were planters in the same area.
Yeah, they are.
I know even among civil servants, they make this distinction.
Yes.
And I was just wondering how C.P. Correa could be sort of one of the leading critics of British on this point, and acquiescing his brother's activity.
Why do you say acquiesce? There's a point beyond which you can't influence, and you've got to influence merely by example.
Sort of final two spheres there. Would it be correct to say that before the Donomo Commission, that's really before the Marxists came, our moderate politicians were broadly rightist and capitalist in their economic thinking, without really having very clearly defined views.
I think so. Well, I think that our moderate politicians are all professional men.
Yeah.
They had no big capital. They would aim at a modest competence. On the other hand, the better minded among them would have strongly the idea that they should play fair as a public duty as well as a personal duty of theirs to play fair by their employees and so on, but they accepted capitalism as a system without any question or doubt. Don't forget, something was a shock to people in Ceylon when a labor government was first formed in Great Britain. Then they got disappointed also, because they thought now a labor government would be strongly anti-imperialist and would be in a great rush to liquidate the British Empire, whereas they found that actually labor was only